Support for WKAR is provided by MSU Alumni Association, offering opportunities for networking, alumni enrichment, and community involvement with MSU alumni in your area and across the country. alumni.msu.edu. And by Fluke Hearing, finding ways to help people hear like nature intended, with 16 locations including Lansing, Jackson, Grand Rapids, and Ann Arbor. FlukeHearing.com.
Welcome back to Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. You may well know by now, August 28th, here, week after next, marks the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington. And Current State is interested in hearing your stories about that day, the 28th of August, 1963. Did you hear Dr. King's I Have a Dream speech on the radio? Or maybe did you watch it on television? Did you march with Dr. King in Washington? Whatever your perspective on that historic day was, if you want to help Current State commemorate the event, shoot us an email. Send us an email with your story, with your recollection, currentstate@wkar.org. We look forward to that segment. Lots coming up this hour. We'll hear from the author of this year's One Book, One Community entry. That's called The Yellow Birds. We also talk with as established a Michigan broadcaster as you'll meet, George Blaha, the voice of Spartan football, among other things, of course. And we remember a Michigan broadcast legend, the late, great J.P. McCarthy, all on Current State today. At the top of the program, beginning in 2014, that's 4.5 months from now, much of the Federal Affordable Care Act takes effect. The landmark law aims to ensure that U.S. citizens have access to quality, affordable health insurance. In the process, the controversial law is already altering not only the way individuals get health care, but the way American businesses, large and small, operate as well. Yesterday, I spoke with Rob Fowler, president of the Lansing-based Small Business Association of Michigan, about how small businesses in our state are responding to the Affordable Care Act. In the first of several such conversations here on Current State, I first asked Rob Fowler what the most common response of Michigan small business people is to the ACA.
I think the most common reaction is confusion or a lack of understanding to the point where I think a lot of people have sort of buried their head in the sand until it became real. The news that certain parts of it aren't going to be enforced until later, I think, adds to that confusion. So what we hear from our members, and frankly we're spending a lot of time helping them comply with the law, is just confusion.
Confusion over what? Can you go any deeper there?
The reality is it would be a little like trying to understand the entire tax code to figure out what applies to you. This is a very large law, but parts of it apply to companies only over 50. Parts of it apply to all companies. Parts of it apply to companies with health insurance. Some of things apply to those who don't provide health insurance to their employees. Sorting out what it means to me as a company is the real challenge. It's a very complex, layered kind of a law, which has a lot of moving pieces today, some now being put off. And I think that's left a lot of small business owners just sort of confused about what they ought to do. And I would tell you, I think it's maybe even the biggest piece isn't compliance. It's strategy. It really is forcing a lot of employers to make decisions about how to compete in this new world. Mm. The reality is small employers have provided health insurance to their employees for a very long time with no mandate. Now, why did they do that? They did it because they needed to attract and retain talent. That's the only reason employers have provided health insurance, to be attractive to employees. I think some of them are will sort of believe that now I've got to decide whether I'm going to continue to do that or I'm going to sort of send my employees off to some other place, the exchange, for example. Mm-hmm. So are they a more or less attractive employer if they have done that? Is that a decision that is going to make you more or less competitive going forward? I think these are all really important strategic and tactical decisions that are implications of the ACA, but not compliance with the ACA.
As an association, has SBAM adopted a position on the Affordable Care Act?
We have. We opposed it from the beginning. We continue to oppose it because of its weight, because of its complexity, because of its cost. You know, the reality is the ACA did very, very little to contain cost. And I think proponents and opponents alike would agree that that was sort of left to do another day. So when you have billions of dollars applied to insurance companies and billions of dollars in taxes applied to medical manufacturers, there's only really one place for that to end up, and that's back at the consumer level, whether it's in insurance premiums or direct costs or whatever. So what we believe is many of the things that part of the ACA actually help drive costs up, and very little in the ACA drive costs down.
How active are you in your opposition? Do you support these ongoing efforts to repeal the Affordable Care Act?
We do. But we do find ourselves in an interesting spot. I mean, that I think part of our job is to be smart enough to understand which hills to die on and which ones not. And the reality is there is some stuff going on at the state level that we find ourselves in support of. And those are Medicaid expansion is one of the issues that's sort of taking up all the oxygen in the room today in Lansing. Exchanges and whether we had a federal exchange or a state-based exchange was something we had an opinion about. So there's what's happening at the state level, but there's also the national, which is where we believe the fight really is, about the Affordable Care Act. Now, I think we've tried to be at least intellectually honest about it. There are parts of it that are good, but there are parts of it that obviously we didn't like, and on the whole, we opposed it. But you know, I don't know that we'll ever repeal it completely. I don't know that that's really a possibility at all. So I'm, frankly, we're hoping for and through our national association pushing for a national discussion about if not Obamacare, then what? We don't long for the good old days of just before Obamacare when there were, you know, 50 million people unemployed or uninsured and double-digit rate increases on a pretty regular basis.
Clarify for me, though, Rob, many of your members, as you pointed out, have always offered health insurance plans. You just said that you support Medicaid expansion as well. Why those two and not a support mm-hmm. of the Affordable Care Act?
Well, again, it's a highly complex federal policy issue, one of the probably biggest in your and my lifetime in terms of its impact on our society and complexity, its weight. And on the whole, we didn't think it was the right way to go. But again, I will tell you, there's some pieces of it. And so let me talk about Medicaid expansion for a minute. That's the one I think that raises eyebrows when we say we support Medicaid expansion.
Mm-hmm.
But I think what we've known for a long time is that because of the way health care is provided in America, if you are poor in America and you can't afford health insurance, Medicaid's available to you up to a certain level. But beyond that, you're in a place where it'd be very, very difficult to afford health insurance. And so what do people do? Most of them don't take very good care of their health until it gets really big, and then they go to the emergency room. And they get health care. We don't turn people away in America from the emergency room. So those costs are assumed and then ultimately passed along to people who pay premiums. That's been our issue all along. One of the biggest drivers of the cost of health insurance today for those who pay premium is covering the cost for those who don't. And because we pass along these uncompensated costs, we absorb those into the rest of the ratepayers, it's a big driver of the cost of health insurance for everyone else. For that reason, we believe Medicaid needs to do its job. It needs to pay for those who can't afford it. And if it did that, there would be less of this passing along. You take a growing group of people who can't afford it, you pass their costs along to a shrinking group of people who are struggling to afford it, and you do that year after year after year. Before too long, the shrinking group of people who struggle to afford it can no longer afford it at all.
Last month, the Obama administration announced a 12-month delay in the employer reporting mandate. Basically, employers will be obligated to prove to the IRS that they offer a health plan or that their employees are otherwise covered. How did your members respond to that?
Well, first of all, this is one of those that only applies to companies with 50 employees or more. And it's interesting, if you just look at the companies with 50 employees or more, 92% two or better percent of them already offer health insurance. So this is the employer mandate when people talk about this. I think what became obvious, and again, one of those things that we warned about as we were trying to oppose it in the beginning, there is a formula in there that defines how you get to how you define who has 50 employees. So let me take kind of a quintessential Michigan story, Schepler's Ferry. Schepler's would have a dozen employees full time all year. So as a company, they would probably have 12 full time employees. But in the summertime, they'll have 700 employees. And according to the ACA, the way you calculate how many, whether you have 50 or more, there's a very specific formula that means all those part-timers become, you know, so many full-timers.
Okay.
And it puts Schepler's over 50 employees, which requires them to provide health insurance to their employees or pay a fine of $2,000 per employee. Well, that doesn't really work for a big seasonal employer like that. In fact, it probably would put a company like that out of business. You can't charge enough to pay those costs. And I think there's been a recognition that those and other of these kinds of stories, it's never quite so simple as you got 50 employees or you don't, have caused the policymakers to step back and say, we have to figure this out. We're not trying to put seasonal employers out of business. So I think they realize they have to fix that. And that, I believe, is one of the drivers of the delay in the employer mandate, because it's complex.
It's just taking a long time to sort that out.
And there are big unintended consequences, and I think they're trying to give some time to sort it out.
That was Rob Fowler, CEO of the Lansing-based Small Business Association of Michigan. We'll continue our conversation with Mr. Rob Fowler on the impact of the Affordable Care Act on Michigan small businesses soon here on Current State. It's Current State on WKAR. Elvis will be in Ionia this weekend, at least in spirit. The Michigan Elvis Presley Fan Club has arranged a concert for the King with several Elvis interpreters at the Ionia Theater on Sunday. Today is the 36th anniversary of Elvis's death, and yet, many years on, he continues to attract devoted fans. WKAR's Melissa Benmark spoke with one of the co-founders of the fan club about the concert.
I'm Jennifer Thede, and my husband Scott and I co-founded the Michigan Elvis Presley Fan Club in 2009. And we have about 2,200 members now, and we offer free membership. So that's really nice for anyone with an Elvis interest, you know, to be able to participate in our fan club. And we try to do various things throughout the year as kind of benefits for them. Like, we work with Elvis Presley Enterprises on certain things, our concerts, which sometimes are more than annual. But this is an annual event, our 2013 Michigan Elvis Day. We work to get like a t-shirt made so that if they're going down to Memphis to Graceland for Elvis Week, they can represent our fan club. So there are different things that we do to get ourselves out there and in the community and grow the Elvis community in Michigan.
How did you happen to found the fan club?
Well, my husband and I separately were Elvis fans from a fairly young age. And when we, you know, got together, it was really great because we had that connection. But it really kind of cemented when we went to our first Michigan Elvis Fest, which is in Ypsilanti, the second weekend in July. And we realized that, you know, you kind of hear, you know, how cheesy Elvis impersonators are, you know, growing up, you know, it's kind of sometimes a joke, but you realize that so many of these guys really pay attention to their craft and really try to honor Elvis's memory, and they're more Elvis tribute artists versus impersonators. And so we really enjoyed those live concerts that we were seeing and how they interacted with the fans and how the fans responded to them. And I think it's just another way to enjoy Elvis's music, which is a great legacy and, you know, just three different great eras, 50s, 60s, and 70s of different music, you know, in his career. And it kind of changed throughout the years. And There's just so many good songs. So we really enjoyed doing that. And then we decided that the fan club, we were having a hard time sometimes finding information on where these concerts were, who was doing them, et cetera. And so we wanted to have a web presence. And then through Facebook and Twitter, too, we have a social media presence so that people could come to our website, www.milvis.com, as a central hub for information about Elvis happenings in the state.
So tell me about the event this weekend in Ionia.
Okay, so we had the 2013 Michigan Elvis Day. We started it in 2010, so it's actually our third one. We missed last year, but we're trying to, like I said, grow it into an annual event that people can come to. They do Elvis Week down in Memphis. It's going on right now. It's always encompassing August 16th, which is the day that Elvis died in 1977. So, but there are people like us who maybe don't have the time or the resources to make it down to Memphis, but that still want to come together and remember Elvis and, you know, enjoy the music that he gave us. And we have three great tribute artists, plus we've added a couple of local people, actually some young guys, one from Jackson, Michigan, and one from Ionia that are pretty young, and they're going to give us their songs and their love of Elvis, too. So we have, like I said, two award-winning tribute artists, plus a rockabilly band out of Grand Rapids coming to the show. There's also, like, we kind of replicate what's called the candlelight vigil that they do down in Memphis. We don't have candles, but with cell phones or glow sticks, we'll try to recreate that. And it's just a time to come together and remember everything that Elvis gave us. So it's something that we're, you know, proud to have started in Michigan, and we hope that a lot of people come out and attend.
I hesitate to ask this. Are you old enough to remember when Elvis died?
I was not born. Well, I was born. I'm sorry. I was born just a couple. I was just a couple years old when Elvis passed. But, you know, like, I think that's one of the great things, too, is that his music attracts all generations. And when you go to these Elvis events, hopefully including ours on Sunday, you see a lot of the younger generation, you know, young kids, sometimes teenagers, too. And that's really nice to see. You know, I fell in love, I guess, or, you know, got excited about his music through the miniseries Elvis and Me. That was the Priscilla Presley biography.
Oh, okay.
So that's how I got into it. And I listened to Elvis for a couple years straight in middle school. And but, you know, it always, you know, and it kind of left my life for a while, you know, just, you know, doing more regular, normal teenage things. But it's nice that it's back in our, you know, my life, and, you know, you can see how much he meant to so many people.
You ain't nothing but a hound dog, you're crying all the time. You ain't nothing but a hound dog, crying all the time. Well, you ain't never caught a rabbit, and you ain't no friend of mine.
My mom often talks about remembering when Elvis's music came out, and kind of what, you know, for her generation, why people liked it and how it seemed very daring and that kind of thing at a time. But I'm wondering, for you, just in your heart at the end of the day, when you've been listening to some of Elvis's music, what do you feel that it really touches in you? You know, not coming to it from the standpoint of someone who saw it as really, you know, groundbreaking for that age.
Right. Well, I know when I was younger, and I know he had already passed on, but he was really a gorgeous man. I know when I was younger, you know, initially there was like, wow, he was really attractive. And then you get into the music, and if you like that kind of retro nostalgia stuff, which a lot of people do, that certainly appealed. And then when I was more of an adult, and I really kind of only listened to his early stuff, you know, when I was younger, that appealed to me. But as an adult, I really started to appreciate the music from the 70s. He did a lot of great covers of songs like Bridge Over Troubled Water, Proud Mary, just a lot of great music. And you could just, the connection was always there with his audience. And, you know, it still is. So, you know, he has something magical, and that's why we want to celebrate him.
Jennifer Thiede, the co-founder of the Michigan Elvis Presley Fan Club. For Current State, I'm Melissa Benmark.
Wise men say only fools rush in, but I can't help.
I'll Remember You, a concert for the King, begins at 2 o'clock Sunday at the Ionia Theater on Main Street in Ionia.
Shall I stay? Would it be a
It's Current State on WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. George Blaha has been the radio and television play-by-play voice of the Detroit Pistons since the 1976-77 NBA season. He's also the play-by-play voice of Michigan State Spartan football. Blaha announced his first NBA game from Cobo Arena on October 23, 1976. He's had a variety of color analysts, including former Detroit Pistons players Dave Bing, Vinnie Johnson, Kelly Trepuka, Bill Lambeer, Rick Mahorn, and current partner Greg Kelser. In 2008, Blaha was elected to the Michigan Sports Hall of Fame. WKAR current sports host Al Martin recently spoke with George Blaha about his distinguished broadcasting career and his early thoughts of sports coverage.
Oh, I was a young kid. We play ball all day, whether it was baseball, football, or basketball. And then I'd listen to the games on the radio at night and say, could that ever be me? If it could be, it'd be a dream come true. And, you know, the more I listened, the more I liked the idea, and the more I locked onto it. And I think if that's your – whatever your dream is, you should follow it. And I was fortunate enough that it worked out for me.
That is great, George. So you knew – very early that you wanted to be a broadcaster. You didn't ever think about going pro in any sport. You knew that you wanted to go right into broadcasting it?
Well, if you're good enough to play a sport, that might be different. But
true. Very true.
But, no, I honestly, from a very young age, thought it would be a wonderful way to spend my life. And I think I felt then, and I still feel now, that If you are a broadcaster and you care about the fans and you care about the teams and the players, you can bring a little enjoyment into people's lives who spend their time, most of their days, working hard just trying to make a living. And when they sit back to listen to the games, if you can entertain them, you're doing a good thing.
George, you announced your very first Pistons game on October 23rd. 1976. Talk about that moment, and were the nerves kind of flowing at that point?
Were they ever? the first game I broadcast was the Washington Bullets. Mm-hmm. They changed the name years later to the Wizards, and the Detroit Pistons at Cobo Hall in Detroit. And the two gentlemen who came out for the opening tip were both future Hall of Famers and huge, mega men, Wes Unseld for the Bullets.
Wow.
And the guy's become a great friend of mine and one of the all-time great human beings and players, and fellow Hall of Famer Bob Lanier for the Pistons.
Mm-hmm.
And then I said, maybe I better buckle my seatbelt here. This is this is where the men play.
Right.
And it was an exciting night. In fact, it was so exciting. I lived in Okemos then. And when I got my car to drive home, I ended up in Gross Point.
Did you?
So I had to, turn around and head back to Okemos. I finally got my head on straight.
Right.
And started thinking about the task at hand.
Wow.
And I was getting home.
Right, right. Your mind was just everywhere at that point.
Right, it was gone.
Oh, my goodness. Ladies and gentlemen, we're talking with truly a sports broadcasting legend, George Blaha. He is play-by-play voice for the Detroit Pistons and also the Michigan State football team.
Kick of his life. Oh, they'll fake it. Bates throws it.
He's got him.
Yeah, wide open. He's got Charlie Gant inside the 10. He can walk in. Spartans win. Touchdown, MSU. A 29-yard score. Notre Dame caught absolutely flat-footed Jim Miller.
Now, George, you've worked with many color analysts throughout your time. Now, I'm going to put you in a hot seat a little bit here, I can go through a little list right here, including former Detroit Pistons players such as Dave Bing, John Mengelt, Vinnie Johnson, Kelly Trepuka, Bill Lambier, Rick Mahorn, and of course, current partner Greg. I hope Greg, depending on how you answer this, I hope Greg isn't listening right now, but who is the best you've ever worked with when you talk about a color analyst working with you?
Well, I don't think you could ever argue with Gregory Kelser.
Gotcha.
Because he's so prepared, he's such a gentleman, and he wants to do a good job, but he wants to make sure he helps you do a good job.
Mm-hmm.
That's the kind of person that he is.
Kobe Bryant really running his mouth.
Well, he has
it's his world right now. He wants to be traded. He wants to be traded somewhere where he wants to be traded. And that's the name of that tune.
He's become really animated since coming back into this game. But the difference has begun with him sitting on the bench. You can give, as we indicated earlier, Jordan Farmar a lot of credit for that. But Kobe came in to help seal the deal.
I tell you, I've never worked in the booth with anybody that I didn't truly enjoy in the NBA. I've also worked with Hubie Brown, Mike Fratello, John McLeod, mm-hmm. the late, great Dick Carter, Ron Rothstein. I know I'm forgetting. Oh, Kevin Lockery.
Kevin Lockery, yep.
Murph was awesome. And Dave Bing mm-hmm. and all the Pistons that you mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
And many of them, including David and Vinnie Johnson and Rick Mahorn and Bill Lambier, are friends of mine. But Gregory and Donna just stopped by our place up north about a week ago.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we're close, and it's been fun working with them, I'll tell you that.
Definitely. Now, you chose Gregory out of that list. Now, you and Greg, now, speaking on my behalf, George, I've been listening to you guys since I was, goodness, 4 or 5 years old. I'm a huge Piston fan, and seeing you and Greg do your thing, I mean, it's something that's a part of my childhood and will always be. I mean, just to be a part of individuals' lives in that area that you are as being a broadcaster for the Pistons, I mean, how humbling and special is that for you when you think about that?
Well, it is humbling, and it's an honor for somebody like you to say that we've been there with you that long.
Yeah.
And I hope it's been a good thing, and I hope it's entertained you and made your days a little brighter. But we certainly are privileged to be part of people's lives.
You and Greg, George, when you guys first started out, I mean, if you turn to Fox Sports Detroit and look at you guys, there is undeniable chemistry there. How does that chemistry develop between two individuals broadcasting the game over time? What was it like when you first met Greg and first started broadcasting with him?
Well, you know what? We go back long before we ever called a game together.
Mm-hmm.
In my early years broadcasting, and I just started with the Pistons a few years before that, Gregory came to Michigan State to obviously play for the Spartans.
Mm-hmm.
And I was a close friend, still am, of Gus Kanakis, who recruited him to Michigan State, who started him on his road to stardom. Then they changed coaches to Judd Heathcote, who's also a heck of a guy and a heck of a coach. But I got to know Gregory through Gus when he was at MSU.
Right.
And we were friends back then, or at least guys who knew each other and liked each other. And then through his time as a Detroit Piston, don't forget,
right,
he was a top five pick in the draft and started his career with the Pistons.
Yep.
Before he was traded to Seattle. So I knew Gregory then. When he first started getting into broadcasting, mm-hmm. I was doing about half radio and half TV,
mm-hmm.
and he joined me on the radio.
Now, before I let you go, I want to bring up something that has become a hallmark of your career. You have countless amounts of count that baby in a foul. I mean, George, I mean, I could go on and on with that list. How did you come up with these things? Because they've really stuck when it comes to broadcasting culture.
Well, it's nice of you to say that. You know, they just kind of come out. And, you know, if I forget that I said them, I may never say them again.
Right, but right.
Sometimes they come out, and people seem to like them, then I'll keep them.
Right.
And so I think to a degree the fans have had something to do with that.
Yeah.
I didn't sit around dreaming that up. It just came out one night, and everybody seemed to like it, so I've been rolling with it ever since.
Well, George, before I let you go right now, can you give us just one quick count that baby in a foul? Really, just one, and then we'll say bye.
Count that baby in a foul.
George, you are the man. There you go. George Blaha, broadcasting legend, play-by-play announcer for the Detroit Pistons and also the Michigan State football team. Hey, George, you take care.
All right, happy to be with you. Go green and go Pistons.
Your feedback is always welcome, indeed encouraged, here at Current State. On Wednesday, we explored the reasons behind the growing number of Michigan parents choosing not to have their children vaccinated. The trend has led state health officials and many physicians to join a campaign promoting the advantages of vaccination. Our guests were Dr. Matt Davis, Chief Medical Executive in the Michigan Department of Community Health, and Mary Toko, Director of Vaccine Research and Education for the group Michigan Opposing Mandatory Vaccines. Current State listener Dennis Blankenship vigorously protested Ms. Toko's appearance in the segment. He writes, "The topic of whether vaccines are safe is thoroughly settled science. The activists to which you granted credibility will not be convinced by facts, science, or experts. She is convinced of her position despite all evidence. WKAR should never have given her a platform from which to spread her misinformation." Dennis, we appreciate the feedback and the viewpoint, but we stand by Ms. Toko's appearance on the program. The impetus for the segment was data showing Michigan has the fourth highest rate in the nation of parents getting religious or philosophical waivers to vaccine requirements. We felt, with that statistic, there was value in hearing the rationale. We also feel the other guest, an informed, practicing physician, had adequate opportunities to challenge Ms. Toko's views. Get us your views. Our email address is currentstate@wkar.org. The One Book, One Community program encourages MSU students and East Lansing residents to read the same book and then consider it together. This year's title is The Yellow Birds, a novel by Kevin Powers. He'll give a talk about the book at a public forum on Sunday, August 24th, and he'll address MSU students on Monday the 25th. More related events are scheduled into September. Powers is a veteran of the Iraq War, and The Yellow Birds reflects his experience. It's the story of two men serving together in Iraq and how one man's death affects the other. Current State Scott Pohl asked Kevin Powers about his own tour of duty in Iraq as a U.S. Army machine gunner in 2004 and 2005.
You know, our job was to go outside the wire, as they call it, to go off base and look for IEDs. And that's how I spent most of the year that I was in Iraq. And really the way that it informs the book is I spent so much time reflecting on my own experience and talking to people who didn't have a relationship with the military or a family member, you know, people who didn't really have any kind of context for understanding what that experience was like, that, you know, I felt like I had an opportunity to at least ask some of the questions that were being asked to me. And I try to do it in a way that I thought would be accessible and hopefully thought-provoking in the book.
I'd like to ask you about choosing the title, The Yellow Birds, because it comes from an Army marching cadence. It's got a vulgarity in it, so I'm not going to ask you to repeat it on the radio, but I wanted to ask you why you chose The Yellow Birds as the title.
I don't know. It seemed to me to resonate with the sort of strangeness of the experience. The exposure to violence, the extraordinary amount of discomfort, deep discomfort, you know, mental, spiritual, however you want to think about it, that comes from both participating in and witnessing violence on a scale such as the scale that occurs in war. I don't know, there's a way in which a person becomes accustomed to that. Not that it ever gets less unsettling, but it's as if you're kind of the mean of your experience is sort of reset towards this stranger end of the spectrum. And the cadence just seemed to kind of represent that aspect of the experience. And, you know, I remember very clearly in my own life going to the basic training, hearing this cadence and being made uncomfortable by it, being shocked by it. But then eventually, in the same way, you know, it's kind of on a larger scale, this happened in more, this cadence became something that I came to embrace in a way. And I thought it would just kind of be, you know, an interesting way of setting the reader the kind of guidepost for the kind of story that would be told, a story about coming to terms with one's, you know, responsibility for the things that they've done and witnessed, trying to understand what your place is and all of that, trying to figure out how it is that you went from being a person who was shocked by that to being a person who doesn't see anything remarkable in that kind of violence, and then trying to find your way back. So it for me, it kind of resonated on a number of different levels.
It speaks to violence against innocent life for no good reason.
It absolutely does. Yeah, I mean, violence for the sake of violence, violence is a kind of performance. It did, and of course, you know, it wouldn't be incorrect to think of the characters as having a similar kind of trajectory as the birds and the cadence, the sort of helplessness. And in a way, these characters are on both sides of that relationship. In some ways, they're victims, and in some ways, they have a lot to take responsibility for. So that kind of internal conflict, particularly that we get through the narrator, is something that I was really interested in exploring.
For the curious, if we've piqued their interest, this cadence is recounted early in the book. So if they're mystified about what we're talking about, go
right.
Find it in the book. Now, your narrator is Private Bartle. He's 21, and he's thrown together with an 18-year-old private named Murphy, and their link is solidified when Bartle meets Murphy's mother and promises her that he'll bring her son home safely. You use the technique of making it clear throughout The Yellow Birds that Murphy doesn't make it, but that doesn't rob the story of its tension. It's an interesting approach.
Well, I'm glad that you thought so. No, I mean, I resisted having the kind of narrative payoff be Murphy's death. There was something about, even on a sort of structural level, of having that information as a reward made me uncomfortable. So I wanted to focus on another aspect of that. I mean, the fact that one of the characters is going to die. You know, getting that information out of the way early, I felt like it gave me more room to explore the kind of consequences of that, the choices that lead to those events, the things that happen to the people. Particularly the narrator, who's the closest to Murphy, and there was just something about it. I wanted to find a way to keep readers interested, but you know, it's a story about war, and I wanted to be up front and not kind of dance around the fact that these are the kinds of things that happen in war. People do die. I didn't want to give kind of false hope either. So it was something that I spent a lot of time thinking about. How to approach that in the best way.
You didn't need a gotcha moment. Oh my gosh, he died.
Yeah, and I absolutely didn't want that. No, I mean, I set that out as a stark line for myself. That was something I wasn't prepared to do. The story becomes, you know, about what happens to this person that leads him up to dying. What happens to the people around him? How did looking at the kind of internal struggle rather than the question of, you know, will these people be killed or not? I mean, that was something that was not what I wanted to focus on.
The East Lansing MSU One Book, One Community program is interesting in that incoming Michigan State University freshmen are assigned to read the book before they even arrive on campus, and people who live in East Lansing are encouraged to read the same book at the same time. And then a series of events are held where it's hoped that Young MSU students and people who live in the city will get together to consider the book and the issues raised by the book chosen in any given year. So I wanted to ask you about how it makes you feel to have your book chosen for a program of that sort.
It's an incredible honor. I think it's such an extraordinary idea to kind of engage the community on every level. And you know, for me, because one of my kind of core beliefs and primary motivations for writing this book was because I do think that the imagination is kind of the root of empathy, you know, that by engaging in art, whether it's a novel or a film, that we actually do get closer to understanding each other and, you know, to play a small part in this really amazing thing that happens in East Lansing is it's really cool. It's really exciting for me. I'm really looking forward to coming and getting to participate in that.
The Yellow Birds is this year's selection for the East Lansing MSU One Book, One Community program. Events will kick off at 7 p.m. on Sunday, August 25th, with a public talk by author Kevin Powers at the Hanna Community Center. Powers will also address incoming MSU freshmen at 9 a.m. on Monday the 26th at the Breslin Center, and he'll also visit the East Lansing Public Library at 4 p.m. on Monday the 26th. Kevin Powers, author of The Yellow Birds, thank you.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
For Current State, this is Scott Pohl.
Two years ago, dragon boat racing first appeared on the Grand River in Lansing. Now, the Capital City Sprint's Rowing Regatta makes its debut. There are more than 140 entries from 14 rowing clubs from Michigan and Ohio in the competition, and the race takes place tomorrow from 8 a.m. to 4 p.m. at Grand River Park along Main Street in Lansing. Here to tell us more about the Capital City Sprints is Mark Alley. He's on the organization's board, and many Lansing residents remember him as the city's former chief of police. Mark Alley, welcome back to Current State.
Well, I appreciate having a few minutes with you today. Thank you.
Yeah, sure. How did the idea of establishing a rowing regatta come about exactly?
Well, the Lansing Rowing Club has been in existence for the past 20 years. We've got a boathouse right on the Grand River, and we're in between the Michigan State University Varsity Women's Boathouse and the MSU University Club Boathouse, and we go around the state rowing in regattas ourselves and racing, and we have such a fabulous time that we thought that it would be appropriate for us to put on our own regatta and bring people right into Lansing from all over the state and, for that matter, all over the Midwest to enjoy the beautiful Grand River and everything that Lansing has to offer.
Now, you were also involved in the Dragon Boat competition that started in Lansing a couple years back. Is this an outgrowth of that?
Yep. So this is certainly we love Lansing. I will say that the Lansing Rowing Club, and we love our Grand River. So we are encouraging people that there are a number of different sports that people can take up, whether it be dragon boat racing or rowing. Our club puts on a learn to row class every summer, where we'll get about 30 people that. We teach how to row. Rowing is wonderful exercise for young and for old. It's a full body workout. Rowing has been around since the 18th century, so for lots and lots of years, Olympic sport, as I think most people know, and it's a very technical sport. So we're fortunate that in this race we have a two-time former Olympian and in the same heat, a person who won a very prestigious race in Boston called the Head of the Charles in Boston. So we're just excited about the day. As you said before, we've got 14 clubs from all over Michigan and Ohio coming in, and which includes the University of Michigan, and obviously Grand Valley State and Michigan State University. So we've got college rowers, we got novice rowers, we got high school rowers, and we got old people like myself and my comrades are rowing. So it's going to be a great time.
Sounds like quite a spectacle. Now, is this a free event, or are you charging admission?
It is absolutely free. People can come right down. If everyone knows where the Michigan Princess is, they can come down, and we will work closely with the Michigan Princess. So the boat is actually going to be open, so people can watch the race from the upper deck of the Michigan Princess, and they'll be serving drinks and snacks on board there. And the finish line is right there at the Michigan Princess. So it's going to be obviously very exciting, and also on the banks of the Grand River between Martin Luther King Jr. Bridge and the Grand River Park there. So lots of viewing available, free to the public. We encourage people to come down and learn more about what a sport that myself and the Lansing Rowing Club really love.
Mark Alley is a member of the board of the Capital City Sprints and the former police chief for the city of Lansing. The Capital City Sprints Rowing Regatta begins tomorrow morning, 8 a.m. at Grand River Park on Main Street in Lansing. Thank you, Mark Alley.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having us.
Current state on WKAR, 18 years ago this morning, brought the sad news of the death of beloved Detroit radio personality J.P. McCarthy. J.P. ruled the morning airwaves at WJR for 30 years. Current state contributor Russ White worked with J.P. McCarthy for the last 5 years of his life and has this remembrance of the great voice of the Great Lakes.
Ditto, Mr. J.P. McCarthy.
J.P. McCarthy.
Now, Paul Harvey News.
Good morning, Americans. For 30 years, Detroit has gone to work smiling, listening to J.P. McCarthy on WJR. Detroit is mourning this morning. It was a blood disorder which ended J.P. McCarthy's life in its 62nd year. Paul Harvey. Good day.
I'm J.P. McCarthy, and always have been.
It was really an honor for me to work with the late, great J.P. McCarthy, to grow up listening to all those radio heroes of mine on WJR, and then to get to work with them, particularly J.P., was just a dream come true. And J.P. ruled the radio dial long before iPods, satellite radio, and people watching Today and GMA in the morning. And he was one of the first DJs, if you will, to work talk and interviews into his music hall, says WJR colleague Mike Worf.
JP.
I was here in 1964. Joe came on about a month later after his sojourn in San Francisco. And people forget that he was, at one time when he first came back, both the morning and the afternoon guy. But he decided he wanted to do the focus. And this is where he started to perfect the art of conversation. That's what Joe was. I mean, we talk about interviews and his eloquence and so on and so forth, but he was a conversationalist, and he made the listener the third party. You know, he would talk to the guest, but the listener felt as if there were only three listening.
Hi, J.P. McCarthy, just calling very early this morning. He's on his way to the office, the chairman of the Chrysler Corporation, day after his proudest moment, Lee Iacocca. Good morning.
Good morning, J.P. How are you?
I'm terrific, and I want...
J.P. McCarthy, WJR.
President Carter, Mr. President, you look so well. Thank you for coming.
I'm getting along fine. I always feel good when I come to Detroit.
Aboard Air Force One with President Bush, Mr. President.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States. Good afternoon, Mr. President. How are you?
I'm great. It's nice to talk to you again.
Radio 76, J.P. McCarthy.
I've been doing this for a very long time, and I never thought I would do one thing for this long. I thought it would get boring, get stale, get old, and that I would too. But frankly, I enjoy doing what I do, and I hope to do it for a good deal longer. To be around for as long as I have in this business is remarkable, and there isn't any one thing that I feel the most warm about. I think it's the whole thing. Good family, close family, good friends, close friends, quality time with the people I love. That's what really counts. And enjoying coming to work every morning. That's a part of my life, too. The moment I stop enjoying it, looking forward to it, being surprised by it, I'll probably stop doing it.
Well, I was looking in the mirror this morning after I'd finished shaving and wiping just the last bit of shaving cream off the end of my nose. I stared at myself and I said,
"You have the cool, clear eyes of a seeker of wisdom and the truth."
The thing I learned most from my time with JP is that anything is possible, and you can do a lot in 30 seconds.
Have a nice day.
For Current State on WKAR, I'm Russ White.
JP.
And you can hear more from Current State contributor Russ White every Sunday afternoon at 4 on AM 870 on MSU Today or visit SpartanPodcast.com. And if you spent time listening to J.P. McCarthy in his heyday, you're undoubtedly aware of an American group also known for being very radio-friendly. That would be the Rascals. That's their song Groovin', which dominated the radio airwaves in the spring of 1967. The New Jersey band created a string of memorable top 40 hits between 1966 and 1969. Fans of the Rascals learned on Wednesday that the reunited original band, Felix Cavalieri, Eddie Brigati, Gene Cornish, and Dino Danelli, will be appearing in Detroit this November. The Rascals, Once Upon a Dream, is described as a combination concert, Broadway show, and documentary of the 60s, all in one. It's been performed on Broadway and around the East Coast. The show's producer, guitarist Little Steven Van Zandt of Bruce Springsteen's band, calls that hybrid the next evolution of the concert experience. The Rascals, Once Upon a Dream, appears at the Fox Theater Detroit on Friday, November 15th. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Wharf. Joe Lindstroth is the producer. Thanks to producer Emmanuel Berry, to Aaron Young for engineering, and Yensia Wong for production assistance. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.
Support for WKAR is provided by MSU Federal Credit Union, providing credit union members with 24-hour account access online and with mobile banking, insured by NCUA. And by the Lansing Regional Chamber of Commerce, supporting more than 1,100 businesses in the greater Lansing area for more than 110 years. Information at lansingchamber.org.